Welcome to Modern Signed Books. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their lives and writing with art book specialist, Roger Nichols. And don't forget to pick up a copy of your favorite books at bjbooks.com. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. We are pleased to welcome Robert Gleason, one of the rare breed who has excelled both as an author and an editor. He's the author of a number of books, both fiction and nonfiction. He's worked in New York book publishing since, I believe, there were stone chiseling things on the walls. He's also one of our foremost authorities in all things nuclear. He's lectured on the subject multiple times at Harvard, appeared on media outlets as Veritas Sean Hannity and National Public Radio. His latest book, The Evil That Men Do, came out earlier this month. Reviews are solidly and well-deservedly five-star. We're very pleased to welcome Robert Gleason. Good afternoon, sir.
Well, thanks for having me.
What an absolute delight. Now, I have to say that one of the things we all know in publishing is that you can't copyright a title. If you look up The Evil That Men Do on Amazon right now, you'll find 15 different books with that title, including a Buffy the Vampire Slayer entry. This is not that. This is a really good one. I like Amazon describes it as Robert Gleason brings his A game to The Evil Men Do, a terrorism thriller steeped with equal parts terror and wit. Last year when we discussed your previous book, An End of the Fire, you noted that...
What was that review? From whom?
Amazon.
It's okay.
The blurb on Amazon there.
Yeah, okay, good.
And of course, you didn't bring the A game. Last year when we discussed your End of the Fire, you noted the more dangerous the supervillains are and the wittier they are, that gives you a lot more potential to make your protagonist smarter. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Yeah. Absolutely. The stronger, the more evil, the more interesting the supervillains, then it gives the heroes a chance to really extend and expand their own abilities. They have to really be just absolutely fabulous in order to cope with those people. I mean, how do you cope with somebody who's really so really overpowering? And it really ought to bring out the best in your protagonists because they have to come up with their bests in order to survive and hopefully prevail.
Yeah. And we have some old friends here from End of the Fire. I really appreciate revealing more about Jules, Meredith, and all the other folks involved here. This is great stuff.
Well, so some people have claimed that Jules is based on, Jane Mayer, who wrote Dark Money.
Ah.
It turns out that Jane's middle name is Meredith. I had not realized that when I wrote the book. But she's got a book, one of the great, great pieces of American nonfiction of all time, Dark Money, which had enormous impact on me. This book not only has nuclear terrorism in it, it's about the global movement toward oligarchy, which is fantastically frightening and in many ways kind of inexorable. And she really documented that in Dark Money. So it had a profound influence on me. I really couldn't have written the book without her. So I have Jules Meredith has a book called Filthy Lucre. And she's does a lot of TV, and she does the. There's a character named Danny McMahon, which some people think is based on Bill Maher. McMahon has a very funny, satiric talk show called Get Real, and of course Bill Maher has a show called Real Time, and in any event, he's very funny, and she. She's friends with when the book opens up, she's doing the Danny McMahon show, Get Real. And so a lot of people, and then of course the two supervillains, everybody says is based on Donald Trump and on Vladimir Putin.
Well, when you call your American president character JT Tower and talk about somebody who's building things and trying to ban people from certain countries and whatnot, I wonder how we could come to that conclusion.
Yeah, well, and they have a thing in New York. They're putting up a couple of dozen of them, and they're just fantastically ugly. They're called needle towers. That they're like 100 stories high, and one of them is like rectangular, but they're only like 44 feet on edge, and they're square. and 44 feet on edge, but 100 stories high. And they're really ugly. And what they do is they rent them to super rich people around the world. And you can buy like a condo, will take up a whole floor. So you have a 360 degree view of New York. And they're completely non-utilitarian, that they're just a place for super rich people to park a lot of money. Most of these people, they buy those condos through shell corporations, so you do not know, anonymously, so you do not know who the owners are, and they pay cash for them. So, I mean, anybody that pays that much cash for a condo, somebody once said, that's presumptive evidence of bad behavior.
Right. You have a lot of fun with the characters in this. Your character, who is the head of the Soviet Union, just detests the phone calls he gets from the American president so much that he finally takes drugs after each one.
Yeah, his nerves are so jangled, alcohol won't do it. He's got to go straight for it. They have a thing, it's causing a gigantic epidemic in Russia. And they have this drug called desomorphine. Its street name is the crocodile, and they call it the croc. That if you the way they cook it up is they'll mix ether, alcohol, vodka. They'll throw in a splash of gasoline, believe it or not, and they boil it up and they inject it or they smoke it in bongs, and so that's what. And of course, Putilov thinks he's so strong and strong-willed. He thinks an unknown. That nothing could ever addict him. He'll be in for a big surprise.
Yeah.
But he can't. His hatred of power is so pathological that it's the only thing that can calm him down after his phone calls with Tower. In the Bible, Jesus Christ believes that the obsessive love of money. Wealth for wealth's sake, the accumulation of wealth for wealth's sake, piling up of riches, just endlessly. That, as John Maynard Keynes said, is intrinsically pathological. And in the Bible, that both in the New Testament, Christ, and also John on Patmos in Revelation, they believe that love of money will eventually drive Homo sapiens into extinction. And the reason that God comes down and destroys the world in Revelation is that we become obsessed with money. The Antichrist controls all financial transactions. So in chapter 13, an angel comes down and says that you're either going to give up your obsessive need, you're going to give up dealing with the Antichrist, or I'm going to destroy the world, and we're going to send you'll spend eternity in hellfire and brimstone. It's where the phrase hellfire and brimstone comes from. And a third of humanity goes, we can have money, but then we got hellfire and brimstone, money, hellfire and brimstone. I'll take the money anyway. And yeah. So God comes down, he destroys everybody, and destroys the world, and he sends a third of humanity howling into hell. But it is fairly clear that the Trump administration, among other things, has been trying to sell 44 nuclear power plants to Saudi Arabia and its Arab allies, an extremely volatile, unstable region. And if you look at the demographics for Saudi Arabia, that country could blow up any time. But we're ready. Nuclear power plants are starter kits for a nuclear bomb program. You have a nuclear power reactor, you're 99% of the way to building an atom bomb. Reprocessing the spent fuel is a low-tech, easy-to-accomplish job. Cobbling together a crude but powerful Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb, you can do it with off-the-shelf parts. It's not that hard. Luis Alvarez, who built the triggering mechanism for the Hiroshima bomb, said once you have the bomb-grade highly enriched uranium, he said a high school kid could build a Hiroshima bomb. We're trying to sell that. We're complaining about Iran and Iran's nuclear weapons program. Who do you think sold Iran its first reactors that got them started in the nuclear bomb business? Who sold Pakistan its first nuclear reactors, got them started off in the nuclear bomb business? United States. We've sold this stuff all over the world, started in 1953 with Adams for Peace. And it's all, like the Bible says, it's all for the love of money. It's clear we will do, that Americans will do anything to make money, including leveling St. Basil's Cathedral.
Yeah.
And putting up a hotel with a really classy casino.
Really classy casino. That'll fix it all, right? And you also point out, or you know, it's always danger to interpret the character's voice as that of the author. But in some cases, mm-hmm. I think maybe I can. One of the things that you brought out is that we basically picked the wrong side in the Mideast, because you know that Trump's demand to ban people from six countries because they supposedly pose a threat. You point out no one from those nations ever killed anyone on U.S. soil. No. Yet the Saudis and their Sunni allies have murdered U.S. Americans on sure. soil by the thousands.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, notoriously, 15 out of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudis. They're the ones that bankrolled, gave ISIS and Al-Qaeda their seed money. We discover now that several of the Saudi royals were financing the 9/11 hijack. So it's, you know, they and yet, and you know that it's. I said in one of my books that the problem with Saddam Hussein and the Iranians is they never knew how to play Americans. You know, if Saddam Hussein had hired some really swinging, freewheeling ambassador to the United States, and he'd gone around like the Saudi ambassadors, you know, lining the coffers of influential defense contractors, lining the coffers of our politicians and presidents, the way the Saudis had done. If Saddam had done that, instead of hanging him, we would have built monuments to Saddam Hussein. We, instead of raging at the Iranians, we'd be building monuments to Ayatollah Khomeini. If he had bribed people the way the Saudis do. It's one of the things that bothers me about the Saudis. They know us too well. They know how to play us. You can see, you know, Trump follows them around like a lapdog. The Bushes always did. It's quite frankly stupid and disgusting.
And as you point out, this is not new. I mean, we've been cozying up to oligarchs back into the robber baron days, and also you mentioned the case of Great Britain in the 1930s acting in deference to Hitler, to colluding with him.
Oh yeah, it's if you read Manchester's three volume biography of Churchill, which is magnificent. I can't recommend it highly enough. In the end of the second volume, he points out that we talk about the British appeasing Hitler. That's a euphemism. They collaborated financially with him. They were making a lot of money off him. And one of the many things they liked about Hitler, aside from he was increasing their personal bottom lines, was that when Hitler took over in Germany, he destroyed the labor union movement in Germany. One of the reasons that Alfred Krupp and Farben and those guys supported Hitler was they complained they had trouble with their unions. They hated unions. And Hitler said, "Don't worry, when I'm in office, no more union problems." And he was true to his word. And you can't believe how that resonated with the English upper classes. And even as Hitler was steamrolling through Belgium and the Netherlands in the early 40s, that they were still, that some of these guys were, I think it was Lord Halifax, was still trying to figure out how to cut deals with Hitler.
Yeah.
They weren't just appeasers, and it was all, and as Manchester points out so beautifully, it's a marvel. The ending of the second volume is incredible. They did it all for filthy lucre.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, getting back to this book, and again, every time we talk, we end up talking about everything under the sun but the book. But this is again, an extraordinary book, and some serious things are going on here. And I won't spoil any of the plot points, but I will say that they're threatening to blow up the United Nations, that the oligarchs, look, they're going to defend themselves any way they can, using any means they can. And it takes a vigorous, in this case, a billionaire cybersecurity expert, the reporter Jules, and an ex-CIA agent, Elena Marino, and a whole bunch of other folks to offset this. And it's not easy.
Yeah, well, but I'll tell you, it's that Putilov, in collaboration with some Saudis, wealthy Saudis, and that is, and some very powerful wealthy oligarchs. The UN has a plan, and it's in the beginning of the book, so it's not a spoiler. The UN has a plan that the oligarchs have taken are taking over the world's democracies, and so the UN has a plan. 1/3 of the world's GDP of the oligarchs' money is in offshore black hole accounts, and we know how to get to that money now. So the UN plans to expropriate about over half that money. And Putilov, as I said, that in Russia, that 100% of Russia's GDP is in offshore black hole accounts. Putin is the biggest thief in the history of the world. William Broder estimates his net worth to be $200 billion, which is 2.5 times that of Jeff Bezos, who's the second next to Putin's second richest man in the world. So Putilov in the novel, he conspires with the Saudis and some wealthy oligarchs to respond to the UN's mandate to take their money from. He responds by attempting to nuke the UN. And there's a long history of democracies biting the dust through precisely these kind of events. General Tommy Franks, who was in charge of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the 2003 Iraq War, he retired as soon as he took Baghdad, which I never understood. Could you imagine? General Franks had it exactly right. We had 9/11, then on 9/12, the Congress passed the Patriot Act, which gave away a lot of America's civil liberties. And I think if there was a nuclear 9/11, then there could easily be a half a dozen nuclear 9/11s in a half a dozen cities. Oh, I think something like that, Americans would instantly surrender their freedom to a tyrant. It's happened to many democracies, going all the way back to ancient Rome when there was a time of civil unrest and civil strife, and the weary of all the internal fighting, that the Senate handed the reins of power over to Caesar Augustus, who then codified Caesar's tyranny. But it happened in revolutionary France and revolutionary Russia. It happened to the Weimar Republic. People forget that Russia had a democracy. They had a genuine democracy under Yeltsin. And if you look at the economic statistics, Russia was more prosperous under Yeltsin than it's been under Putin. Putin's more popular, but that's because he's a better demagogue than Yeltsin was. And he's convinced the Russian people that they're besieged on all sides by enemies, and Putin's the only man that can save them. And that, Putin gained dictatorial power, got rid of the democracy in a coup by blew up four square blocks of urban apartment complexes, and then blamed the Chechnyans for it, and then used that as, like Hitler used the Reichstag fire to gain dictatorial power. I could easily imagine a nuclear 9/11 be the end of the American democracy, which is sort of a paradigm I was looking at when I wrote The Evil That Men Do.
Yeah, and it's a perfect title for this. I mean, it's absolutely spot on, as the Brits say.
Caesar's, it's from Mark Antony's funeral oration in Julius Caesar. He says, "The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones." And it's so true.
Love that quote, indeed. I'm probably going to have to roll out of here, but I do have to want to mention that if people who are listening have enjoyed this, by all means, check out the latest book, The Evil That Men Do, and get a signed copy from VJ Books. Yeah. Delighted to provide it.
May I mention my website?
Absolutely.
It's www.robertgleasonbooks.com. Gleason is GLEASON, and there's lots of all the reviews are there. I've been on a lot of TV radio shows. There's some links to some of those. And it's robertgleasonbooks.com. Robert Gleason Books is one word, GLEASON.
And by all means, keep on your expertise in writing and do a great job tomorrow when the people are going to interview Behind Line. We'll have fun with that.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm looking forward to that. We all thought the world of Robert. It'll be a lot of fun to go down memory lane.
It did. Hey, thanks so much for spending time with us again. We really enjoy it. And if you're by any chance at the World Science Fiction Convention in San Jose, we'll have a beer together.
Yeah, I would love that. I don't think I'm going to make it though this year. I got a bunch of other things I have to do. One, there's another conference that falls on the same time and that I have to go to. So, but right. We are sending a bunch of editors, of course.
So. I think so. Hey, thanks again. You're a gem to talk to.
Well, thank you so much. You All take right. care. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Modern Sign Books. Make sure to follow and comment on who you would like to hear next. Feel free to check out our other author interviews. And visit vjbooks.com to pick up signed copies of all of your favorite books.